Tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome for the first time Aaron Dietz, PhD, author of An Introduction to Confucianism, speaking about the subject of the superior person in original Confucianism. He is a has been recommended to us by a speaker who's graced this space many times before, Nick Egan, and we're very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Thank you so much. This is, by the way, our first talk on Confucianism in almost 8 years, long overdue. We're very grateful.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, that, you know, that basically hits on one of the key points why I got into Confucianism in the first place is because, in my own understanding and in a lot of the literature I was reading on my own after my BA, there was a big gap there, I thought. And, you know, more in hindsight, I realized that there was a big gap there. But just to give you a little introduction about myself and how, I came to become interested in Confucianism, I started off going to San Diego State University wanting to basically play soccer. Academics at that point were, in the background. I went there because it had Division I soccer, business, graphic design, and architecture. Through a series of events, I didn't make the soccer team my first year and went to my first class, which was a ethics and values class, philosophy 101, and it just knocked my socks off. And I was sold on philosophy starting then. Later I realized that was just an outstanding teacher that I had, and I went through a series of classes with less than outstanding teachers as far as my interest level went. And after about three more years, I found that teacher again teaching a class on Far Eastern religions. So we began a little bit with some of the classics, pre-Confucian classics, got into Confucianism, went into Taoism, and ended with Zen Buddhism. And then I met my wife. She was going to Sonoma State. I had friends there. I always used to go hang out at Sonoma State. And basically threw everything aside my last semester and went to go be romantic and chase down my wife and did that whole thing. And so then, luckily, over the course of the next year, managed to still piece together the remnants of my BA. But I think could have used a little bit more Confucianism at that time to just kind of keep myself reined in and make it to the next step before I went all romantic. So I think that would have made things a lot easier all the way around. So that being said, after that point, yeah, I know. I mean, it worked out for the best. Worked out for the best for sure. But definitely, I think made things a little bit harder if I would have waited a little longer. But after moving up here, I had a gap between about a year between when I finished my BA and started my MA. And during that course of time, I did at least receive from my teacher down there a list of different books that I could read on my own that were very, very interesting, of course, but really didn't find anything on Confucianism. And really, like I said, I in my own personal life and in my own, as well as my reading, didn't really value Confucianism, didn't really find much about Confucianism. And didn't really have that much of an interest as far as making it a priority to pursue. So then, finally, made my way to start my MA, and the first class I took was called Confucian Classics. And once again, just like, for my Western philosophy class, this Chinese philosophy class just knocked my socks off as well here. Because, before I found that MA program, I was looking at MA programs on mysticism in England and really going that route. And once I made this turn into my MA and got settled in the school in San Francisco, the Institute of Integral Studies, if any of you heard of it, Nick Egan, who speaks here, also went there. He and I took many classes there together. But once I finally ended up there, took this Confucian classics class, I realized that there was a lot of spiritual torque in simple things, in ordinary life. My mind at that time was, like I said, thinking about very high mysticism, kind of going away from you know, thinking that maybe everyday life, ordinary things, that's kind of, I don't know, just to be scoffed at type of thing. But getting into that first class of Confucian really reoriented me towards examining daily life. And that being said, I just want to, the way I was planning on proceeding is I did write, basically self-publish my dissertation into a book here. And I was going to, you know, use it to keep myself from getting too far afield and keep the discussion going. Just kind of picking out three chapters to discuss from there. But as far as some of the things that started to knock my socks off from that initial reintroduction to Confucianism was that I feel like Confucius did such an outstanding job of not only encouraging learning, higher learning, but also reorienting that learning towards daily affairs, reinvigorating the concept of thinking about humanity and human beings. We all are human beings, clearly, right? And we all have this particular skill set that is comes with being a human being. So Confucius brings all of that spirituality back down to that fundamental level of just the fact that we are human beings. So the key term for original Confucianism in the Analects is humanity, and humanity is in Chinese it's like on the left side it's a radical for that's human being, and then it's just two right there. And so you have human beings and two, so it's sometimes translated as co-humanity. But the point is that the most important thing with that skill set, the fact that we are human beings, is relating from human being to human being. And that's where we have all the energy for spiritual transformation, for our spiritual progression, is within the field of human beings relating to human beings. Now, what makes it even more interesting is that I feel like Confucius really kind of put his money where his mouth is, so to speak, where he took that idea and started thinking about, well, you know, as human beings, how do we very first start learning about humanity? And the very first place we start learning about humanity is after we're born, we start having a relationship with our mother and father right off the bat. So that becomes a key term in Confucianism called filial piety, which has to do with your family relationships. So all of us, biologically speaking, come from, you know, a mother and a father. Some of us may, you know, a few of us may have had accidents or something like that where we don't have those relationships with our parents, but at least at that level, biologically, we do all begin there. And then 90, you know, a huge percentage of us continue learning about human relationships from that very first fundamental arena. So I feel like that shows right off the bat that Confucianism is orienting towards the most simple basic things in our lives and trying to bring those to a higher level, trying to get all of us to see those at a higher level. And also, as far as parents, look at that responsibility with a great weight as your tremendous spiritual practice, even. So filial piety comes from humanity. Within filial piety, there's two other key important ideas. One is your propriety. So, for example, propriety in the sense is, you know, if you're a three-year-old child, you really shouldn't be, in 99.9% of cases, be telling your parents what to do. You just simply don't have the understanding and experience to be able to do that. I use the example of if your you're crossing a busy street, you know, 2-3 year olds, they don't know how to cross a street. They don't have the experience. They don't have the know-how. They don't have the understanding. And, you know, the parents can guide them and say, look, let's get through this danger here, type of thing. A very you know, simplistic example, but I think one that holds true. Now, at the same time, over the years, Confucianism has been abused by people in the higher relationship to say, just do everything I say, obey me. And that's where you see a degradation of Confucianism, and you see a lot of reactionaryism, to coin a term, against that. But that's not, you know, that's not really the spirit of Confucianism. There is an allowance for the child, for example. Like, let's say you're 16 and you've learned some things, and your parents are clearly making a silly mistake, maybe saying something wrong that you learned in school. You don't, out of respect for your parents, you don't want them to go around all through town repeating that mistake. So you would gently try to correct them, tell them that that's a mistake, and that way you're following the spirit of trying to enhance your parents. You're honoring them by doing that. And then, of course, I mean, if they're being obstinate, then what can you do, you know? But you still try. You try a few times there. So that's one aspect of filial piety. The other aspect of filial piety is harmony, simply keeping harmony in our relationships, knowing when to go forward, knowing when to pull back, just keeping that harmony. Basically, humanity is the key virtue that is the seed for all these other virtues, filial piety, propriety, harmony.
Is propriety the Ren?
Li. Ren is humanity. I'm trying to think. I think there's another Ren too, but Ren is the most important one. Is humanity for Ren, J-E-N often spelled, and then propriety is Li. And you know, a couple other key virtues that stem from humanity. Confucius said that he followed one principle, and through that one principle, he could understand, you know, many things. And his definition of that oneness was that you are faithful or loyal to yourself, but also empathetic with others. So what's underlying that oneness is the humanity, but that humanity in yourself, you're faithful to humanity in yourself. And the deeper and higher the understanding you have of that humanity in yourself, the deeper and higher ability you'll have to empathize with others. And so loyalty and empathy are another key couple of virtues for Confucianism. So now what I did is I really, you know, for a dissertation, I didn't want to get too abstract. I didn't want to get... that's another major reason why I chose to focus on Confucianism. Actually, it was a practical reason, because I didn't want to try and talk about the Tao, which cannot be talked about, right? Or talk about no mind in Zen, that sort of thing, and try to, you know, write a long piece about that. I felt would be more challenging than writing about Confucianism. And so, in that vein, I also tried to take the virtues and attributes of Confucianism and embody them, showing the exemplar of Confucianism, the superior person. I tried to flesh out the personality of the superior person by taking all the different instances in the Analects, Confucian Analects, one of the key four books of Confucius, where he juxtaposed the superior person against the inferior person. So I drew all those out, and then what you see is you get a picture of the personality of the superior person. And in that way, you get a picture of Confucianism being embodied, being practiced. And to define the superior person, the first most simple thing is that any of us can be superior people at any moment. Any person can be a superior person at any moment. The only key is that in that moment, you're emphasizing virtue. you're emphasizing righteousness, doing what is right for you in your life at that time, versus what they, like I said, juxtapose against the inferior person, who emphasizes profit as number one. So that is the, I think, main and most simple definition of the personality of the superior person. But from that, drawing out all these different instances of the superior versus inferior person, I was able to also classify five personality traits of the superior person. One, that they are transcendent, so they can kind of be above the fray, so to speak. They won't necessarily get encumbered in factions or seeking different profit. So they have this element of being transcendent. That goes along with an element, the next one, of wisdom, humanity. So almost like, for humaneness, just to give an example, I think to make it a little more clear, there's one particular quote, if I could find it here, that makes it a little more concrete. It gives a four attributes. The master said that Prime Minister Chan embodied four aspects of the superior person's way: humble in living his life, and reverent in serving his Lord. Sorry about the gender specific. But humble in living his life, reverent in serving his Lord, generous in nurturing the people, and responsible in employing them. I think that the superior person is humble because they feel a tremendous responsibility to humanity. They're reverent in serving the Lord, which I think we would take that to be reverent in serving the country, because they take it very seriously to elevate the level of the country, to elevate the quality of humanity. Generous in nurturing the people, I think, shows a very kind-hearted nature, and responsible in employing them, not putting people into positions that are setting them up to fail, being responsibly taking that as a heavy weight, putting people in the best position for themselves. So I think those are four examples that show superior people their humaneness, their humanity, their kindness. So, like I said, there was five. So I have wisdom, transcendence, humaneness, and faithfulness. So they're faithful to their task. They're faithful to humanity. They're faithful to their goal, their will of making a better society, of nurturing people's spirit, nurturing humanity. So faithful. But then the last one I think is great, is because the last one is practical. They're practical. Superior people, it says, they say little and achieve much. So that's practical. That's practical. And they're, I think examples throughout Confucianism, I think practicality is one of the absolutely most outstanding features you see in Confucianism. Like I mentioned before, bringing back spirituality to the origin of just simple filial piety, I think, is very practical. Taking it back down to the familial level. Here's another quote for practical. It says, when superior people can't understand something, they remain silent. Now, superior people understand that speech and action are very heavy, that's part of humanity's tools for achieving these types of goals that we talked about for superior people, like harmony and that sort of thing. So, any questions so far? I know I'm just kind of barreling right along, but that, like I said, superior people, I felt like made it much more concrete to discuss. And so getting the sense of their personality, and then going from getting the sense of the personality, I wanted to get a sense of, yeah.
So there's this concept of the superior person and the ideal. and it's like tradition of Confucianism. Were there instructions for how to, you know, become someone like a superior person, mm-hmm. or how do people go about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Confucianism definitely spawns this sense of a lifelong learning, but also a learning that is oriented towards virtue. So there's, I'm trying to think of the definition for virtue. I can picture the character, but I'm not sure how to turn that into a definition. But the main thing, like I said before, is this idea of choosing righteousness as your number one, a number one objective in every moment of what you're doing. And I think what's helpful there is that I should define righteousness more, because I think one of the first things we hear with some of these terms, you know, part of the reason why I emphasize these particular translations, superior person has been called gentleman, noble-minded person, but for one, superior person, I think, is strong and unique. We already have gentlemen, we already have concepts of noble-minded person, but anyway, noble-minded, we have a concept of that, but the superior person and then righteousness is another one of these terms. Often, when we think of righteousness, the first thing that pops in our head is like self-righteous, and it's almost a negative thing. Or if you think of righteousness, you think, oh, I'm so righteous, you know, just way too high, arrogant type of thing. But righteousness, when you're asking about how does one become a superior person, it's through emphasizing righteousness, and righteousness has three elements to it. My teacher wrote a book called Chinese Philosophical Terms and defined righteousness as one, having, you know, choosing an action that is of harmonious benefit. That's one. So your action has harmonious benefit. Two, you see the action, righteousness is your path from humanity inside. You choose righteousness outside, where to go, what to do, how to respond to life's changes. And the third is path. It's right here, but I always can never remember the three. But there's three different ones. Benefit, your path, and I should be able to remember easily. Harmonious benefit, your path. And I can't remember off the top of my head. I'll remember as I'm going forward. I bet you anything. But yeah,
what was going on in the culture in which he lived,
mm-hmm.
when he started teaching that made it possible for it to become so widespread?
Okay. At the time. First, what Confucius did is that he went around, and at the time, everything was oriented towards lords who had power, and different scholars would go to these lords and try and advise them well, because they knew if they advised them well and they found a really good lord, they would be able to have a lot of influence in helping the society in that particular kingdom. Now, the story goes that Confucius actually, went to visit Lao Tzu, and upon returning from visiting Lao Tzu, there's a parallel quote that says, after this time, he knew his heaven's destiny. And at this time, he stopped orienting towards trying to find a lord to teach to, and started emphasizing education and teaching his students. So I think this is one aspect where Confucius is a radical shift in the society at the time, where he starts democratizing education. Before, all scholars were just, you know, either becoming hermits or trying to enter in the service of a lord. And Confucius at that time, he said he understood his heaven's destiny. He, like I said, started emphasizing education, and it was education, you know, to anyone. And unfortunately, at the time, one thing that was going on in society is that women were not interacting in society they were still generally 99% of the time more cloistered. So Confucius never had women students. And if a woman would have come to him, it might have looked bad, you know, because everyone might have started thinking that he was trying to, you know, hook up or something like that. At the time, that's how people, society was looking at the mm-hmm. relationship between man and woman was just always, almost always that way, you know, except for sister and brother and father and daughter. Other than that, it was just husband and wife. So as far as, you know, that sort of thing goes. But I think the key point is that he did really make this radical shift to turn education to the people, to allow anyone, any man, to become educated. And he had disciples from across the board, which is also pretty radical. He had disciples who were generals. He had disciples who were, you know, country, you know, from the countryside. And he taught to each of their personality. He taught to each of their strengths and weaknesses. He would answer, and this reminds me, I feel like, is the root of the Zen koan in a way, because he would answer the same exact question to two different students in two completely different ways. He would define humanity to two different students in two completely different ways based on their temperament and their personality. So I feel like this, I mean, they consider in China Confucius as the first teacher. And I think that is part of what is going on in society that helped it flourish, is he democratized this type of learning.
Why did society accept a democratized learning when it was a feudal system, it sounds like?
Yeah,
did that go over with the feudal lords?
Well, I mean, this is one of these things where it was, I want to say, almost organic, where in his lifetime he had a very few disciples, uh-huh. you know, a handful of disciples, mm-hmm. and they were pretty much flying, I would say, under the radar. From that, as far as lords watching over them, that sort of thing. It went down to his son didn't really transmit any more of his learning, but his grandson transmitted a tremendous amount of his learning. Two of the four Confucian four books are edited by his grandson, as well as one of the key commentaries I use in my book is called the Ten Wings Commentary. And that was also, they think, edited by his grandson and later disciples, also using some old quotes from Confucius. But the point is that it skipped a generation. And then Confucius' grandson taught the second sage of Confucianism, Mencius. And Mencius, perhaps, is the one who really gave Confucianism a boost, because in that time, society was chaotic, and Mencius was a very, very strong personality, very brilliant personality, who went across, you know, different lands and just was very, very, you know, excellent at arguing, and a very strong, unrelenting type of discussion, where he would say, you know, righteousness is the most important. So all these different feudal lords are looking for a way to govern in these chaotic times. And Mencius would go to look for which one of them is the most virtuous and the most intelligent and the most, also, you know, not going to get wiped away by some other one as well for survival purposes. But that's where the philosophy began to take hold, because he took Confucian philosophy and said, look, you can govern with this philosophy. If you govern by righteousness, that's the way to truly govern a country well. If you govern with law, then the people are naturally going to end up rebelling. If you govern with you know, just love and harmony, then things will still be chaotic and there won't be there won't be like a social structure.
But one of the key principles was obedience to the Lord, wasn't it?
Obedience to the Lord?
Yeah. Did I get it right?
Yeah, obedience. That I was saying that was something that happened where Confucianism kind of went down and got degraded, where a lord would say, I'm Confucius, I'm going to use Confucianism to say, you guys all obey me. So he would abuse it, right? Where you would be naturally wanting to obey someone who was an excellent leader, but also naturally needing to correct them if they're going the wrong way, if you're in a lower position. So obedience to the Lord is something where it was one-sided over the years, and that's where Confucianism has had tremendous, tremendous criticism over the years, because it was abused. I mean, I think the irony is tremendous, because if you look at Confucianism, his goal was to have a harmonious society, and, you know, a humane society where you have a lot of quality of human beings. And then you saw time and again where rulers would take Confucian philosophy and abuse it and become tyrants. And so, you know, I feel like you see the same thing with Jesus, where he went into the marketplace and turned over the tables on everyone in selling, you know, because he was so furious by watching all the buying and selling going on. Now he's the patron saint of the most business-oriented society, you know. So I don't know if there's... Yeah, I think there's irony in both of those instances. But in both cases, returning to the original, you see the solution to the current state, I think.
How long did it take between Confucius and Mencius to when the so-called maybe Neo-Confucianism came up, and with all the fascistic kind of attitude? I mean, how separated are those two?
Yeah, it was Neo-Confucianism was a reaction to Buddhism. So it was over 1,000 years, between 1,000 and 1,500 years later that happened. So also, I think what answers your question as well as that I took that commentary, the Ten Wings commentary, where Confucius and his disciples comment on the ancient Book of Changes. And if you know, some of you I'm sure have heard of that. They commented on that the Book of Changes, and for one, I say that what happens is you can see the type of understanding of a superior person from that, because one of the Ten Wings commentary, one of the chapters of the Ten Wings commentary, basically just tries to outline the principle of change. What is the principle of change? What does it mean? And so what I did in the book is, in my dissertation, and now the book, is that I took from what our teacher gave us in class. He gave us about, I forget how many, around 50 or 60 key phrases from that commentary. That commentary chapter is called the Da Chuan. And so I took those out and commented myself on each one of them. Some examples of what the superior person would do to cultivate an understanding of change, and thus, like, change is considered like heaven and earth, yin and yang. One example is that superior people would try to imitate heaven and follow earth. Imitating heaven, they say that the great virtue of heaven is giving life and giving life and giving life. Heaven has these layers of meaning. Heaven first comes from sky, rain, which gives life to the earth, but then takes it a step beyond, that heaven gives spiritual life. And so then superior people work to do that themselves, to give spiritual life to humanity. So they imitate heaven in that way. And then they follow the earth. They follow what's immediately around them. So there's a number of these different principles here that they say daily renovation, rejuvenation, is the great virtue. So embodying the way of heaven, superior people are every day unceasing. They're every day rejuvenating that, every day renovating that. And that is also an element of heaven from ancient times to now. Heaven, the sun has come, the sun has set. It's this duration. The superior person, every day they're trying to renovate, rejuvenate their spirituality.
Are there practices that go with that?
That's a good question. That's something that I think has evolved, because, you know, for example, my teacher said, and I feel the same way, that he's, you know, 90% Confucian, 90% Zen Buddhist and 90% Taoist, and in Chinese that's still logical, you know, which is one of the, you know, an example of something that I enjoy about Chinese philosophy. So I think that nowadays, I mean, a Confucian can, you know, practice meditation, practice mindfulness. I mean, I would almost all my coursework was actually in Buddhism. You know, now personally, I practice Tai Chi as a moving form of meditation. But as far as practices, I think that a Confucian can, as long as they're reorienting towards daily life and using the daily life and their humanity and their relationships as a litmus test for what they're practicing, that's where that would come in. Yeah, but I think you hit on the next point, which is critical, is that the next chapter is, what is the practice of the superior person? And the practice of the superior person, I outline that by taking each hexagram from the I Ching and looking at the Ten Wings commentary on it called the Da Xiang, which means the great image. So it looks at the I Ching, it basically has 64 situations of change and instructions on how to deal with those situations. Well, these Confucian commentaries tell you how the superior person deals with each of those situations. So, to answer your question, daily life is your practice. So how do you practice righteousness in each daily situation? For example, the second situation of change is the image of the earth. So superior people, they have thick virtue, so they can carry the outer world as the earth does. The earth supports all things. So superior people emulate that by having such thick virtue they can support the outside world. I think I picked out another one that would have been a good example.
36?
Sure. I'm just curious. Sure, 36. Darken to the light. Okay, so it says darkening of the light. The light has sunk into the earth, the image of Ming Yi, darkening of the light. Thus does the superior person live with the great mass. He covers his outside and has the principle inside. So darkening of the light is, in this instance, as far as society goes, that society is in a time of decay. The light is darkening. So the superior person, they live still in society. They don't go away, but they cover themselves so they don't get, you know, into a lot of trouble, because society has a lot of inferior people out there kind of haggling for, you know, wiretapping you and maybe trying to get you into trouble or something like that. But they still keep to the principle inside, right? So they still live in this time, but they return to the inside. They make sure that they're nourishing their virtue. They wait for the time to change again. And if, you know, they do it without having any depression. They do it joyfully, knowing they're waiting for, they're doing their work, they're responding appropriately to that time. And then that was the one, appropriateness. The last for righteousness was appropriateness. But they're responding appropriately during the time. And, you know, studying, maybe writing, so that even if during their lifetime change doesn't come, they're still passing on something for a later generation. They take that as their responsibility. The author of the Book of Changes was imprisoned for years and years and years and years and years and years and years, and wrote the Book of Changes in prison. I think is a good example of that. You know, he couldn't do anything outside, so he formulated this whole Book of Changes to inspire society later on. Yeah. I don't know how we're doing with time. Yeah. Well, and just so that's. The practice there, that there's an example for each situation of change. Yeah.
I'm interested in how this manifested in ritual.
ritual practice in, say, at a home altar, or I don't mean the elaborate Confucian rituals in the big temples, but sort of like something that a Confucian gentleman would have daily engaged in.
Okay, well, the home altar and ancestor worship was the biggest aspect of this, because what you're doing is you're honoring life. You receive life from your parents, that we talked about before. You receive life all the way from your ancestors for so many generations. So when you sacrifice to them, you're showing a deep sense of reverence for life and from that gift from your ancestors from time, you know, beyond remembering. So, you know, they would. Confucius said that, you know, you honor the spirit of that, and when you go to sacrifice, you put incense. Even to this day, they light incense. They give food during holidays. They'll cook extra food and give it to the ancestors. But, you know, Confucius didn't want to talk about a lot of things that sounded mystical. He wanted people to understand that they had enough in their life that was very important to deal with. So he didn't emphasize things like spirits. But here we have this thing that comes even from before Confucius, sacrificing to the spirits. He says that we don't know whether or not they're there or whether they exist. Maybe he knew. He had spiritual power. I don't know. Maybe he knew, but he didn't want to talk about it with anyone. And what he says is that you have a reverential mind, as though they're there. And that way, you're honoring that process. So, other, I think that's the main ceremony that you would do, is that type of sacrifice. So the major component there is that you're sacrificing, you're offering a sacrifice. It's though as though you offer your life to honor that. So the spirit of it is offering sacrifice, and that you offer all of who you are on a daily basis, sacrificing for others, for responsibility, for, you know, increasing the quality of humanity, for having harmonious relationships around you, that sort of thing. You have this sense of that your life is your offering. So, this is the last thing that I wanted to hit on before we wind up or have some more questions, is just that the one more reason why I wanted to emphasize a superior person is because, you know, in our society, in a democracy, supposedly the people have the power. It's not like it was during Confucius's time where we would want to go and make sure the Lord was superior, because then he could help society. Supposedly, when we vote, we're the lords of society, and so then people are so important. So when people emphasize virtue, when people emphasize righteousness, when people continue making an effort to go up in their cultivation, in their understanding, in their practice, that enlivens society. And this is something that I would say is, for whatever reason, it's palpable in China. My wife and I went to China, and we were in the heart of Mao country, you know, after the Cultural Revolution, after all the attempts to, you know, cut away the traditions. You could still feel the warm-heartedness that I know from all my studies Confucianism tries to inspire. You could still feel, you know, the kids would call someone down the street, call them their grandpa, and honor them and laugh with them and play with them. And I've never felt such warm-heartedness in my life as when we were spending our time there. So I feel like a lot of that has to do with that they understood at whatever level, even though it had been cut away a bit, they understood humanity to be good and important, and there had been effort made over generations to increase the quality of humanity. So I feel like that following that is a way for our society. If we have, for example, superior people as farmers, then they'll take it as their responsibility to create righteous, you know, healthy food for us. If we have superior people, as in every different instance, when people are choosing to practice virtue over choosing to emphasize profit, choosing to emphasize humanity, then every different field we have, education, governance, they all will rise up and become much, much better, much more full of life, full of life. So I'll end it there for me, and then if you have any more questions, feel free.
So does your book have the 64 hexagrams in it?
Yeah, you know what I did? I originally put the 64 hexagrams, and you could look at it if you want. I did put the 64 hexagrams in the commentary. Not every 64 hexagram has the... I didn't actually write the hexagrams, sorry, if that was part of the question. Yeah. But
that's okay.
Yeah. So what happened is there's a few instances, a handful of instances, where a superior person is not technically mentioned in that commentary. They instead refer to the kings of antiquity or the ancient sage kings, which, in my opinion, is just a superior person in a position of power. But I didn't, my teacher didn't want me to emphasize those because it didn't technically say superior person. So,
I don't have all
64. I have, like, I think, like, you know, 50. They're all there except for, like, maybe 5 or 6.
Interesting.
Could you say something about the connection between the author of the I Ching and Confucianism? Was he a student of...
Okay, yeah. The author of the I Ching was thousands of years before Confucius. But it's a great question, because Confucius' main goal is Confucius' main goal was to manifest the culture of the ancient sage kings. So King Wen, Duke Chao, Emperor Shun, Emperor Yao. He looked at that as an idealized time where those rulers created an excellent, beautiful society with a lot of amazing innovations. And for example, Duke Cho, which Confucius alludes to often, he created a system of propriety and music. So propriety is, I feel like propriety is empathetic, because when you enter into a social situation, how many times do we all feel like, well, what do? In this situation, it's awkward. But propriety tells you, okay, this is, you know, a way to respond to that situation. And so then you say, okay, now I know how to act in that situation. It takes a lot of the pressure off, I feel like. And some of it became too rigid, of course. And then when it becomes too rigid and against humanity, it's the superior person's responsibility to analyze that and reshape it again. But also, that's propriety on one hand, to make people's outer lives more stable, and then music on the other hand, to make people's inner lives more joyful, more cultivated. So his relationship with King Wen and Duke Cho is that he looked at them as the founders of an excellent society, and it's one of his stated goals many times to try and bring that into his time. And later students of his, like Mencius, also made it their goal to bring that into their time. Later Confucians tried to bring that into their time. So Confucius said he didn't create anything. He only was trying to transmit that into his time.
One more?
Yeah.
You mentioned something about a country in decline and the darkening of the light, hiding the light. In this specific period of time here, with this, what's happening here, without going into any of the politics of it, I felt a lot of anguish in the last 10 years about the direction. Is there an answer for that there, where you're not in denial, you're not ignoring what's happening, but you're not in anguish about the direction?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that what a Confucian, a superior person does, you know, according to these hexagrams, is that, for one, they're cautious with their words, cautious with their actions. Mm-hmm. But two, they are looking at everything from that transcendent point of view, working on that transcendent point of view to understand what is right, what is wrong. And one of the other key principles of change that they follow is they complete everything by twisting. So they'll go indirect methods. They'll go around. They don't need to just go smack up and throw their life away against a brick wall of darkening society.
So if you follow the changing lines in hexagram 36, what does it take you to?
Well, hexagram 36, the way that the I Ching is set up is that there is a linear way that it goes through, so basically it'll go to hexagram 37. but that means that, not to be a smart aleck, that actually means that it's reverse and return is the movement of the way. So hexagram 37, I believe, I haven't written this in the way that it would show it, but I believe what would happen is hexagram 36, the darkening of the light, is when you start retreating, right? And you're going into yourself. The next hexagram is hexagram 37, the family. And so what it says is wind comes forth from fire, the image of the family. So the image of the family is where this energy starts to pick up again. And when you have a healthy family, when you accumulate energy in your home life, you know, family aside, when you accumulate energy in your home life, that's when you can begin to have a solid foundation for going out again. So you see how it reverses. You retreated during darkening of the light. Then one of the principles of change is reverse and return is the movement of the way. So you retreated, now you reverse and you return, you start accumulating energy in your home life, in your family life. That then you have the strength and ability to go back out into society again and do some good work again.
And this is my own thing, but trying to combine that with your question, at least the implied question, is what do you do with the situation? Because I see the retreat as one that's kind of a societal or collective retreat from this top-down to a more empowered community-based culture. Mm-hmm. And from strength there, we can maybe move out into larger groups.
Absolutely. I agree. Yeah.
I'm curious about the link between Confucianism and Taoism historically.
Confucius was said to have gone to visit Lao Tzu and asking him about, I believe it was, propriety. And we don't know what Lao Tzu exactly said, but Confucius was quoted as saying, I saw, you know, a dragon flying in the sky at that time. And when he asked Lao Tzu about propriety, is when, in a different quote, he's talking about, we can pick out of different texts the timeline. And so part of the way we can do that is because there's an eclipse described in one of the different texts, which you can pinpoint as to exactly when that eclipse was. So anyway, then we know that Confucius, after that time, he was 50, is when he said he learned his heaven's destiny. I think he said, at 30, I was established. At 40, I don't remember. At 50, I knew my heaven's destiny. At 70, I could do whatever my heart desired without going against the rules of propriety. There's a historian, Sima Qian, who I believe is the one where we get that story from, Confucius is going to visit Lao Tzu. I don't know. Are there any more questions? I think that's time, though. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much on behalf of Many Rivers. It's my pleasure to thank you again. Thank you all for coming tonight. Point out that we have a donation bowl over there. Encourage you to add to it to support both our speaker and this space. And to point out that we have lots of books here on Confucianism for you to check out on your way out the door. So thanks again for coming. Thank you for coming. Have a great evening.
Thank you.